Welcome back to the Mellow Mama podcast, where I talk all things conscious living and conscious, respectful parenting with the help of lots of great books, resources, and of course, my own experience as a mom. If you're new here, what's up? I'm Kate, and I love emphasizing that parenting is about the parent, that when we focus on cultivating a more conscious, aware lifestyle, we can then incorporate what we're learning into the parent-child relationship and call it conscious parenting. The work of Eckhart Tolle in his book, A New Earth, I find pivotal and transformative for that exact process. If you're someone that wants this authentic, amazing, connected relationship with your children, that wants to model this amazing, authentic, connected, deeply passionate marriage for your children, that wants to model real self-confidence, this intrinsic self-esteem, Eckhart Tolle's book, A New Earth, is a wonderful place to start. Because at the end of the day, when I break down for myself, how do I make all of that happen? It starts and ends with me, with molding and shaping myself and better understanding the root of everything that gets in the way of that. And the root that I find time and time again is insecurity. This underlying story of you're not enough, you're not good enough, a low self-worth story that I've been conditioned to hear and believe from infancy. You're not worthy of connection unless you do X, Y, or Z. And we've covered that in the previous episode specifically when it comes to role-playing and the roles we've learned to adopt and play all throughout our lives. But this particular episode, we're going to talk about the pain body, which is a fascinating subject, but something that is, again, imperative if you are trying to understand, okay, why do I feel like I need to be passive aggressive about this or defensive? Why do I have these reactions where I am in my body responding as if it's an emergency? Like I'm in survival mode. I'm like gripping like my hands like so tight or like clenching my jaw or just feeling like I want to yell or shout or a number of other things that are a survival coping mechanism popping up in the body when we're just with our kids or our spouses, or in traffic, or scrolling our social media, right? Why? What is the insecurity at the root of that? What am I so tied to when it comes to my sense of identity and self-worth that tells me I need to react to that? Eckhart Tolle's work, along with a lot of the things that I share, I really think help the parent or person listening step back into their power, remind you that you are not the thoughts, you are the thinker. You can absolutely shift into a more empowered state, a state of being, a state of presence that leads to a state of joy and lightheartedness, which is where all of the other things, that authentic connection, that like playful state of being can occur, where parenting all of a sudden is a joyful experience and not something that's just so overwhelming and exhausting 24/7, let alone just all of the relationships that we're in, meeting the needs of other people, trying to get our own needs met. It doesn't have to be this tireless, exhausting, helpless thing where we feel like, oh, I just need to maintain control. I need to hold on tightly to this grip of, again, the role that I play, who I am, this sense of self-worth and identity that I've defined for myself and other people. We can just, again, let go and be present. That's where we're at today, and I'm so excited to get started on the conversation for real. So let's start. On chapter 5, The Pain Body, he says, the greater part of most people's thinking is involuntary, automatic, and repetitive. In fact, I just did a little Google search before I started recording because I wanted to know exactly, approximately, what the percentages are here. And it says that 80% of thoughts are negative and 95% of thoughts are redundant. That's crazy. It's so crazy. And a big tell, in my opinion, of what behaviorist parenting has truly done for us in a bigger picture way. And it's not good, right? If 80% of thoughts are negative and 95% of thoughts are redundant, that means that basically all of the thoughts that we're having throughout the day, the large majority of them are just negative and repetitive. We're just having the same negative thoughts and we're talking to ourselves in this horrible, negative, redundant way. It's no wonder that people feel like they're in a rut or they feel exhausted or helpless and they believe the stories that they tell themselves, but they come from our childhood conditioning and they are passed down. The stories, just like the good stories that we hear or the good stories that you have in your family that are passed down from generation to generation, the negative stories that we tell about our self-value are passed down too. And that's something that we can take a look at and free ourselves from. Sometimes when people read Eckhart Tolle's work or listen to the stuff that I share, they feel from an egoic place threatened, like I'm calling them out, like I'm saying, or that I think I'm better than somebody. And what's so fascinating, one, first of all, having a conversation about the ego makes it so easy to be like, well, that's just the ego at work, trying to defend your honor and doing its best to protect you, even though it's sabotaging you, it's stunting your growth. But two, that these are the very people, if you're having reactions like this while listening to these episodes or when you read this book yourself in your own time, understand, wait, this means that I am the person that really needs this the most. If you find yourself to be reactive, to be that parent that is screaming and yelling all the time and upset all the time and just frustrated and you're just like annoyed with your kids, annoyed with your partner, annoyed with life, like just so like getting into this state of victimhood, like why me? Why is everything so hard for me? Why does everybody else have an easier time? Or who does she think she is? Is Kate like on the Mellow Mama podcast, right? If you are that person, this is for you. This is going to free you from all of those negative, redundant thought patterns and allow you to step into the empowered you, the person that is underneath all of those layers, that beautiful, vibrant soul that's underneath all that conditioning of low self-worth and low self-esteem that feels like it needs to protect you. But you're already in there shining, baby. You don't need that. So you can let go and listen. And I think it's just so fun once we actually make that like realization, like, oh my gosh, like this is a perfect opportunity. If I can just let go and remind myself, like, I'm safe. I don't need to defend myself from anybody. I can just listen. I can just listen and digest and then move on from there, a lot of great things can happen. So he says, it's no more than a kind of mental static and fulfills no real purpose. Strictly speaking, you don't think. Thinking happens to you. The statement, I think, implies volition. It implies that you have a say in the matter, that there's no choice involved on your part. For most people, this is not yet the case. I think is just a false statement as I digest or I circulate my blood. Digestion happens. Circulation happens. Thinking happens. But the voice in the head has a life of its own. Most people are at the mercy of that voice. They're possessed by thought, by the mind. And since the mind is conditioned by the past, you are then forced to reenact the past again and again. When you're identified with that voice, you don't know this, of course. If you knew it, you would no longer be possessed because you're only truly possessed when you mistake the possessing entity for who you are. That is to say, when you become it. So take a moment, especially if you're in this negative and redundant hamster wheel, if you are just like repeating the same negative thoughts about yourself, about other people, about your life, stop and notice them. Take a look, like have a little, I'm looking down at myself moment. Pause the thoughts, like literally imagine yourself with a remote and just like pause and notice that you are able to do that. You're able to pause the thought. You're able to stop it and observe it. Because you are not the thoughts that you're thinking. You're the one thinking them. You're the thinker. He goes on to say, for thousands of years, humanity has been increasingly mind-possessed, failing to recognize the possessing entity as not self. Through complete identification with the mind, a false sense of self, the ego, came into existence. The density of ego depends on the degree to which you, the consciousness, are identified with your mind, with thinking. Thinking is just no more than a tiny aspect of the totality of consciousness, the totality of who you are. The degree of identification with the mind differs from person to person. Some people enjoy periods of freedom from it, however brief, and the peace, joy, and aliveness they experience in those moments make life worth living. These are also the moments when creativity, love, and compassion arise. Actually, you know what? I want to stop there, because if you're human, that is, and you're not like, I mean, maybe you're like, oh, I don't need to read this. I actually don't have moments of that. I am incredibly present. That's amazing. I hope to achieve that at some point. But for right now, in the present moment, I can relate to any parent out there who has been in a triggered state, who has felt deeply frustrated or annoyed or upset, you know, like discouraged. The list goes on and on of these uncomfortable feelings that you might have had while trying to balance it all, while trying to meet the needs of multiple children or people, especially barely trying to meet your own needs, right? As a mother, I experienced these feelings often. And I love that he says, like, you get these periods of freedom from it. When you stop identifying with the mind and like believing the thoughts, like actually listening to them and allowing them to have any sort of like power over your emotional state, because thoughts affect feelings, right? They elicit feelings. When we free ourselves from that, we have these moments of peace and joy and aliveness. In fact, that's when we can be creative and loving and compassionate. Those are the things that we need to be conscious parents. Those are the things that, because of conscious living, we can implement them into conscious parenting. And that's why I say, this is going to make your life better. This is going to make your relationship with your children fun and like peaceful and beautiful. And you won't need this escapee wine mom culture anymore. Like, you won't feel like, oh my God, I just need like to get away from it all. I need to get away from my kids. Like, I need to get away from my husband. Like, you won't need to complain about it. And there might be times where you're like, man, I do feel discouraged, or I do feel exhausted, or I do whatever. But it's not going to be the same as like, again, this overwhelming disdain for the function of being a parent, because you'll be operating in that alive space, in that creative state of being, that loving, compassionate state of being, where we can be. We have the space to be curious, deeply curious about the perspective of the other. In some cases, our children. Maybe in many cases, our spouse, who's not quite on the same page as us, or is not on the same personal growth journey as us, or at least the same stage as us. There needs to be the space for this to even occur, though. We need to be able to get away from our thoughts being our sense of self and identity for this part to even occur. And Eckhart addresses the opposite. He says, others are constantly trapped in the egoic state. They are alienated from themselves as well as from others and the whole world around them. When you look at them, you may see the tension in their face, perhaps the furrowed brow or the absent or staring expression in their eyes. Most of their attention is absorbed by thinking, and so they don't really see you. And they're not really listening to you. They're not present in any situation. Their attention being either in the past or the future, depression or anxiety, of course, exist only in the mind as thought forms. Or they relate to you through some kind of role they play and so are not themselves. I'm so excited. I'm really looking forward to having a more in-depth discussion on exactly that. But I want to touch on it really quick. And I touch on this in my course as well. Like, if you are a person that is still in the doing state, this doing instead of being state, especially with your children, it does not matter how many Little League games you coach. It does not matter how many tasks you do around the house to help out. It does not matter the bills you pay, the roof that you put above your children and your spouse's head. It will not translate to I I love you. I'm connected to you. I have a deep curiosity about who you are. And therefore, again, know you, the sense of like being with. And I know that can be sort of discouraging, and it almost makes people sometimes ask me the question, like, well, then what is all of that for? Well, it's not to say that any of that is bad or pointless. All of that can be beautiful if it's done with intention. And also if it's not done in a sort of IOU fashion as well. I know many parents that are heavily tied to the role of parent, especially in egoic sense, where they're like, this gives me my worth and my value, especially if they view the child subconsciously as a sort of accessory to their value. They can get into that habit of, you owe me for this, you know, you should be thankful for what I do. And that's, again, a whole nother rabbit hole. But when we are in a disassociative state, which a lot of this is all just so relevant for the reparenting process, which is why I'm doing this on my podcast. When we're in this dissociative state, we're not present, we're constantly absorbed by thought, that negative and redundant thinking on repeat, just playing like a broken record, we aren't able to actually really connect with our kids. And there might be these blips of freedom where we can, and they feel so good, and it's beautiful to witness, but we really want to be operating there consistently for ourselves, you know, for our own sake, but especially for our children, if the goal is a more conscious, connected, beautiful relationship in which our children truly feel seen and connected with and heard by us. It's not possible if we're stuck in this state. And I know all of us listening know people in our lives that are operating here, where you might talk to them, but you know they're kind of like waiting for their turn to say something, they're waiting to talk about themselves or their own circumstance or situation, or they're not paying attention at all, not present, or they'll interrupt you. Or same thing with like your children, right? They just don't get it. They don't understand it yet. And that's because they're stuck in the thought patterns that were handed down to them, passed down to them from the time of them being a child, right? And the thoughts all root back to this same, okay, how am I going to get my needs met for survival? It's honestly crazy when it breaks down that simply, like these just basic insecurities of I'm good. How do I prove that I'm good all day long? And proving it to themselves through their thought patterns. And sometimes it's proving that you're not good enough or that you are not as good as other people. That's also ego. That's also the ego at work, the pain body at work. And I think this part too is really interesting. He says, most people are alienated from who they are, and some are alienated to such a degree that the way they behave and interact is recognized as phony by almost everyone, except those who are equally phony, equally alienated from who they are. My husband would call these people tryhards, whereas I'm like, oh, dang, they are just truly trying so hard to be important, to feel seen, to feel like valuable. Alienation means you don't feel at ease in any situation, any place, or with any person, not even with yourself. You are always trying to get home, but never feel at home. Some of the greatest writers of the 20th century, such as Franz Kafka, Albert Camus, T.S. Eliot, and James Joyce, recognized alienation as the universal dilemma of human existence. Probably felt it deeply within themselves and so were able to express it brilliantly in their works. They don't offer a solution. Their contribution is to show us a reflection of the human predicament so that we can see it more clearly. To see one's predicament clearly is a first step toward going beyond it. This is why I always just say awareness is courageous. Being vulnerable is the first step. If someone in your life or you listening, first of all, if you're still listening and this is you, I'm so proud of you. It's awesome because that really, it's courageous. It's a courageous thing, especially when we're wired for survival and your thoughts, you know, and your ego have convinced you for so many years, one, that you are them, that you are your thoughts, and that they're true, and you have to listen to all of them. You can't just stop them anytime. But two, that like your ego and all these identifications you've tied yourself to, or the person in your life that you maybe thought of, like, oh shoot, like that's totally them. Like they're totally operating there. And that's why I feel like this disconnect, that's why I feel like we can't move forward, why we can't keep growing, like we can't level up. We're kind of stuck. If that's where you're at, like being vulnerable is truly like the first step, and it is genuinely scary. It's like your body is saying, this isn't safe to do this. And I mean, there are many, many reasons from a reparenting aspect, but when we look at even today's culture, like a pediatrician will tell you, leave your baby alone, let them cry until they stop asking for their needs to be met. And this is early on. This is like in less than the first year of life, we're conditioning our children to stop asking for your needs to be met. Stop. I don't want to hear it. Don't try to communicate your needs to me. It's not convenient for me. Stop it. Stop crying, right? Stop it. I don't want to hear it. Shush, shush, shush. Pacify them. And again, like, don't let your ego stop you from hearing this, okay? Because this is to help you propel forward and be so deeply connected and curious with your children, with yourself, with your spouses. When we're conditioned from day one to stop communicating our needs, things like this, being vulnerable and expressing our needs now, after years of that conditioning, is scary. So it's okay if you're having that experience, if you are getting defensive about this work, if you do feel like spouting off some sort of passive-aggressive remark at me, even though you maybe don't know me, I feel like that's okay. It's your body and your ego trying to protect you. But you can step back and say, it's all good, you guys. Like ego, thoughts, all the different parts of you, little 5-year-old you or 10-year-old you or 19-year-old you that are trying to keep you safe, all these roles that you've played. You can say, hey, present me right now is safe. It's okay. I can evaluate this stuff so that I can step into a more empowered version of me. It's all good. I don't need to be protected, and I definitely don't need fake protection that's actually going to sabotage me. And when you do that, again, it can be scary, but this is the first step toward going beyond it, freeing yourself from it. Let's move forward to the birth of emotion. He writes here, in addition to the movement of thought, although not entirely separate from it, there is another dimension to the ego, emotion. This is not to say that all thinking and all emotion are of the ego. They turn into ego only when you identify with them and they take you over completely. That is to say, when they become I. So emotion is the body's reaction to your mind. He goes on to clarify the difference between an emotional response and an instinctual biological response to our environment, and how they might look the same and definitely feel the same from an emotional standpoint, but one is very different from the other. The fundamental difference being that an instinctive response is the body's direct response to some sort of external situation, whereas an emotion, a feeling that we get, is their body's response to a thought. That's where, again, the awareness piece becomes just so vitally important to shifting into a more conscious state. Understanding that absolutely we can be empowered to say, I don't need to be controlled, especially in my responses, by the thoughts that I think. This concept is particularly inspiring to me as a mom because, and for all parents it should be, because most parents that come to me that want to take my course or that are wanting to do some sort of consultation all have the same goal, and I do too. It's to eliminate these responses that are unhealthy for my kids, unhealthy for me, uncomfortable for me, like yelling, having the urge to be like rough, or, you know, just even not such extremes, but like wanting to utilize shame and manipulative tactics, wanting to be critical, understanding, okay, what are the thoughts that are leading me to feel the way that I'm feeling and then have the reactions that I'm having that are fight, flight, fawn, freeze based. If you want to be critical of someone or shame someone, you want to manipulate them to feel bad, to do what you want them to do, this is just fear in your body creating that response. The feeling that you need to manipulate them or something bad will happen. That something bad could vary from person to person, but typically it's like the something bad is if you don't manipulate this person in front of you in whatever way, by shaming them, criticizing them, hitting them, yelling at them, being rough with them, right? Then they are going to be bad. They are going to be whatever. You are then going to be a bad parent. That's going to make you a bad person. All of it stems, in my humble opinion, back to our sense of value, our worthiness. And if we can kind of like rank our little worthiness tank and we can fill that up and remind ourselves, I think that it makes it easier to not have these responses. But then we also have to not put our children, again, like I mentioned my worthiness blueprint podcast episode all the time, but it's because it's extremely relevant. We have to also not roll that exact same thing out for our own children that we can, again, then be fearful about them not living up to and then us not living up to. It becomes a whole cycle. But I find it really inspiring to understand this concept of like all these emotional responses are is a response to thoughts. Guess who gets to be in control of your thoughts? You do. I do. This is great news, especially because there's a big difference between what our body is trying to do, like what it's designed for. The survival instincts that are built into our biology are not meant for battling off anxious thoughts, fear-based, control-based thought patterns. We absolutely get to be empowered and say, I don't need to be run by that. And I feel like I'm beating a dead horse because I've said that already in this episode, but it's extremely relevant for parents. And I know that if you are a parent, you understand. He says here on the next page, although the body is very intelligent, it cannot tell the difference between an actual situation and a thought. It reacts to every thought as if it were a reality. It doesn't know it's just a thought. To the body, a worrisome, fearful thought means I'm in danger, and it responds accordingly. Even though you may be lying in a warm, comfy bed at night, the heart beats faster, muscles contract, breathing becomes rapid, there's a buildup of energy. But since the danger is only a mental fiction, the energy has no outlet. Part of it is fed back to the mind and generates even more anxious thought. The rest of the energy turns toxic and interferes with the harmonious functioning of the body. And how many of us have been in that situation, right? This is all too common. And again, just in my opinion, great news that we can acknowledge it and say, hey, wait, it doesn't have to be that way. I can be the awareness behind my thoughts and say, oh, that's just a thought pattern. I'm gonna shift that. I'm gonna move away from that. I'm gonna think differently, and I'm going to be the active awareness behind it. That is conscious living. And the same cycle happens for parents, right? In the midst of the grocery store, when your child is having a really hard time, they're flailing about, they're freaking out, and they're disappointed about something. The urge to fix and change and to correct, to criticize, to shame, whatever, it's all based on thought patterns. And those are fear-based, control-based thought patterns that aren't rooted in what's really happening and the reality of the circumstance. Is it uncomfortable? Is that the reality? Yes. Why is it uncomfortable? Probably due to thought patterns having to do with what other people might think of you, what other people might think of your child, what you think of you, what you think of your child. And that's, again, where we can step into this more conscious version of ourselves, be the awareness behind those thoughts. Be the awareness behind what's going on, the fear that's even happening within us, and say, whoa, 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 whoa. Okay, that's not helpful. And it's also just not accurate. It's irrelevant what someone else thinks or what a past conditioned thought pattern thinks of me and my child, and what the inner critical parent voice is saying right now about my child or me as a parent. what's the solution here? Is it normal to be disappointed? Right? We can move into the extra conscious state of being, which is, I think, curiosity. And completely the opposite direction of fear and control, where we can just simply relax, be present, and be curious. What is the behavior that I'm seeing communicating? What is the need that my child is trying to have met? Is this developmentally appropriate? Is my child overstimulated, hungry, tired, probably just bothered by being in the store for so long, they're being so patient, right? Is my child potentially just so disappointed because they are so excited and or so happy about something that they saw and it's hard to not get the things that you want in life? Is that relevant for us too, right? Like, you can go down this list and then move into empathy and move into connection, the real presence, the real conscious state of being. When we get out of catastrophizing mode, thinking of every worst case scenario to try to protect ourselves, just like I mentioned before, and realize that we're sabotaging ourselves, sabotaging our own opportunity for peace, both inward and outward peace, we can easily move into what I like to refer to as smooth sailing mode, where it's really hard to get us worked up because everything is about a solution, right? Like, okay, well, what does my child really need? Can I meet their needs? No? Okay. Can I meet their need for connection and understanding and compassion? Yes, I can do that. How can I do that? By not letting my thoughts run the show and by letting my awareness take center stage, baby. And another layer of this awareness comes into play when we even talk about positive emotions. I really like how Eckhart Tolle just doesn't miss. Like, he addresses everything, every layer. So I want to talk about this. He says, what is a negative emotion? An emotion that is toxic to the body and interferes with its balance and harmonious functioning. Fear, anxiety, anger, bearing a grudge, sadness, hatred, or intense dislike, jealousy, envy all disrupt the energy flow through the body, affect the heart, the immune system, digestion, production of hormones, and so on. Even mainstream medicine, although it knows very little about how the ego operates yet, is beginning to recognize the connection between negative emotional states and physical disease. I really like when people use the expression, disease is caused by dis-ease. I think it's a really interesting thing to be reflecting on, and again, another piece to the bigger picture when it comes to being a conscious person and parent, like considering every aspect of your well-being and having that start with your thought patterns and conditioned thoughts and how you respond to them and the emotional state that those thoughts put you in and all of those thoughts that make up your ego and just like how to address them from really taking into consideration your childhood experience, your adolescent experience, and getting back to this pure state of being where we're no longer identified with that. He goes on to say, an emotion that does harm to the body also infects the people you come into contact with, and indirectly, through a process of chain reaction, countless others you never meet. There is a generic term for all negative emotions, unhappiness. Again, he just doesn't miss, because that is such an important aspect of especially what we're focusing on here. If you are a mom or dad listening, we often are in survival mode, not actual survival mode like we're talking about here when we get into this negative thought pattern, emotional reactive state. What I'm talking about is when like you just have to try to meet so many people's needs at one time. It's so overwhelming. It goes without saying, like being a parent sometimes is very overwhelming. It requires a lot of preparation. I really do believe it requires a lot of this work and this reflection daily, or we can just slip right back into old patterns and conditioning, and we can have negative thought patterns that really derail us when it comes to cultivating this inner peace for ourselves and this peaceful environment energetically for our household, our family, our children, our spouses. And I think that that's again a really, really important thing to be considering. We are not just, you know, it's not just about us. Parenting is about us. I say that a lot. parenting is about the parent because it all starts and ends with us. But how you speak to your children, how you speak in front of your children about yourself, about others, the way that you interact with the world, the way you are in traffic, the way you order a coffee, the way, like, all of that affects how your children go into the world and do the exact same things. And all of those little tiny micro interactions that you have with people are going to affect the way that they operate in their very own day. And we really are all connected. And I just think that it is a beautiful thing to consider that one person developing a more heightened conscious awareness in their day-to-day life can literally have a massive impact. And, you know, sometimes I feel like if I read too many of my comments on TikTok or something, I'll get discouraged. I'll feel like, oh, I'll just feel discouraged. And I'll think like, oh, nobody, this is like only a very, very, very small percentage of people are willing to try to understand the stuff that I'm talking about it and share. Like they're not even ready. They don't have the capacity right now from their own conditioning to even receive this information. And it feels disheartening for me. I feel discouraged because I just want to help them. I just want to help them have more peaceful days and better relationships and like just feel better and to thrive and like have like joy-filled days where it's like truly peaceful. And I don't know, if you're not new, then you know that, like, you just know that, because I feel like I say the same thing all the time, but, like, it's really my goal, and so I can get to this, like, place where I feel discouraged, but then this is such a wonderful reminder for me, and for anybody listening, if you've ever felt the same way, like, nobody gets me, nobody understands, like, why this is so important to me, or why I'm so passionate about this. I know so many people that listen to my work, and, like my YouTube channel and stuff, they do come to me and send me messages or emails saying, you know, it's really like, I love this so much and it's made such a big impact on my relationship with my child or my children, but man, my husband has a really hard time with it, or man, my mother-in-law really gives me a hard time about it, or my own parents like just really take it very personally. And It can be really discouraging sometimes. So I just want you guys to really hear that reminder loud and clear that just having this awareness and operating in this way in your own house, like just with one person that you love so much, and just the way that you show up in front of them all the time, even in your hard moments, like the way that you acknowledge that that's human too, and that you're human and that's normal, and it's about how we recover from those kind of ruptures and hard moments, and but understanding where they come from in the first place, like that is actually making a very big difference in the world. And that sounds so cliche and goofy and dramatic to say, but I really believe it to be true. So hear that reminder. But now let's go back to talk a little bit more about the difference between a negative emotion, unhappiness, and positive emotions, because I like that he clarifies this too. Positive emotions have the opposite effect on the physical body. They strengthen the immune system, invigorate and heal the body. But we need to differentiate between positive emotions that are ego-generated and the deeper emotions that emanate from your natural state of connectedness with being. This is a hard thing at first, when you're understanding the concept of the ego and the pain body, to clarify. At least I think it could be. So if you're listening and you're like, well, how could a positive emotion also be bad? It's like, gosh, can I win at anything? Like, but it is a really important thing to start to notice your thoughts, even when they feel good, or even when you start to feel, have like a good feeling, bringing a real consciousness to it and saying like, okay, but could this be egoic, in that it's not a good feeling that's coming from what he says here, from within you as the love, joy, and peace that are aspects of your true nature, but obscured into things that, again, are still connected to those identifications and attachments. He goes to say here, positive emotions generated by the ego already contain within themselves their opposite, into which they can quickly turn. Here are some examples. What the ego calls love is possessiveness, an addictive clinging that can turn into hate within a second. Anticipation about an upcoming event, which is the ego's overvaluation of future, easily turns into its opposite, letdown or disappointment, when the event is over or doesn't fulfill the ego's expectations. Praise and recognition make you feel alive and happy one day. Being criticized or ignored make you feel dejected and unhappy the next. The pleasure of a wild party turns into bleakness and hangover the next morning. There is not good without bad, no high without low. Ego-generated emotions are derived from the mind's identification with external factors, which are, of course, all unstable and liable to change at any moment. The deeper emotions are not really emotions at all, but states of being. Emotions exist within the realm of opposites. States of being can be obscured, but they have no opposite. They emanate from within you as different aspects of your true nature. So take a minute to process that and start to understand maybe when that might come up for you, and just start to bring awareness again to like how this might show up in your day-to-day life moving forward. I want you to especially like before the next episode, for example, just take the next week from the time you listen to this to really start to cultivate this awareness, like a deeper understanding of why you respond the way that you respond. And it might be why you respond in a seemingly positive way even. And sometimes people in my own life are like, hey, it's not that deep, okay? Like sometimes you can just be really excited about something. And I'm like, yeah, obviously. But it's more about, first of all, it is that deep. But and also one of my favorite things, and I've said this a couple times while doing these episodes on Eckhart Tolle, A New Earth. One of the things that I love most about this book and Eckhart Tolle's work and the stuff I've gotten out of it, like what I've gotten out of it on a personal level, day to day in my life, is that it's kind of fun for it to be that deep. Like it's not heavy for it to be that deep. It's actually just really lighthearted after you really start to cultivate this kind of awareness. And you're able to just ask yourself those kind of questions and not have any attachment to it, not associate it with being like bad, that you might have, you know, some attachments, or that might be your ego showing up, or you might be insecure about a lot of things, and like you might have some trauma, big T trauma or little T trauma. Like, it's just not a big deal. I don't know how to explain it. Like, I feel like I got to the point, you know, working on all of this within myself and in my own life and relationships, that I just realized like how goofy it is to make it such a big deal for it to be deep. It's like maybe it is. Maybe everything is that deep. Maybe you do have to unpack a lot of stuff, and it has to be uncomfortable at first because you have attachments to it being like, oh, this is bad that I have, you know, all of these attachments, or like that makes me a not as good person or not as, but that's just one more layer to peel back and say like, oh yeah, that's the ego talking right then and there. That's funny. It's like always showing up, and like, I don't need to, again, let it run my life like it has been for so many years. And you can just get to like enjoy the process and laugh at life, at yourself, at letting go of it, at it being hard sometimes, right? I think that, I don't know. So if you're listening and you're like, it's not that deep, oh my gosh, like I can just have positive emotions and I don't need to like delve into like where they're coming from in me. Well, but I think you can also have a lot of fun doing that and just be like, is that the ego? Like, is this like an egoic attachment thing that's like creating this positive thing? Does it have an opposite on the other side? Like, if this doesn't happen the way that I envision it happening, or if this doesn't have the result that I'm expecting, am I going to be disappointed? I like how he says, like, what the ego calls love is possessiveness and addictive clinging that can turn into hate within a second. It's so true. And that's a really complicated one to dive into and to like try to understand and let go of, especially if you're somebody with anxious or avoidant attachment style. But I think that's a perfect example, right? Like, oh, I love you, I need you, oh baby, but the second like they don't meet your expectations for what love is supposed to look like, you can't stand them. Like, they're awful to you. You're so frustrated with them. Like, or you just, like, all these coping mechanisms come up where you get defensive and passive aggressive. And it's just so interesting that it's so clearly just the ego and egoic attachments and not actual love, like actual unconditional love and acceptance and recognition of the self and the other and a state of being where we, and that's where we want to get to. But obviously, for the people too that are like, it's not that deep, first of all, saying it's not that deep is egoic. It's like, it's a complete defense mechanism, coping mechanism, because it's uncomfortable for them to go that deep, because they like, it might be painful and might make them feel insecure that there's stuff under the surface, right? Like, it's just easier to stay surface level in their mind, right? The ego is telling them that, but it's not true. So anyway, I just think all of it is so good and so interesting and so fun to dive into. So anyway, positive emotions too, you got to start to observe. Sorry if that's bad news, more work for you. But like I said, I think that this becomes really, really fun over time as you start to let go and just be like, yep, there it is again showing up. Like, what am I so attached to? Like, what am I gripping so tightly to? And for what? I'm safe. It's not, I don't need to do that anymore. Like, I don't need to let all that old conditioning continue to show up in my day-to-day responses and reactions and thought patterns. Now, okay, this next part I love. It talks about the duck, but with a human mind. Eckhart Tolle describes how ducks shake it off post-conflict. They might get into a fight and it never lasts long, but afterward they separate and they float off in opposite directions, and then each of them shake and flap their wings vigorously a few times. And they do that to release the excess energy that built up during the fight. And after they flap their wings, they float on peacefully as if nothing ever happened. Wouldn't that be nice? But he goes on to share the alternative as if the duck had a human mind. It would keep the fight alive by thinking and story making. And the story might sound something like, I don't believe what he just did. He came within 5 inches of me. He thinks he owns this pond. He has no consideration for my private space. I'll never trust him again. Next time he'll try something else just to annoy me. I'm sure he's plotting something already, but I'm not going to stand for this. I'll teach him a lesson he won't forget. And on and on and on, the mind spins its tail, still thinking and talking about it months, days, years later. As far as the body is concerned, the fight is still continuing, and the energy it generates in response to all those thoughts is emotion, which in turn generates more thinking. This becomes the emotional thinking of the ego. You can see how problematic the duck's life would become if it had a human mind. But this is how most humans live all the time. And I know you probably know somebody like this. No situation or event is ever really finished. The mind and the mind made me and my story keep it going. And this isn't just, you know, I said you probably know somebody like this, because yes, there are some people that are pretty obvious living examples of this, because every time you speak to them or have a phone call with them, it's like, let me tell you 3 different stories of how somebody cut me off in traffic. Somebody at the register checking me out in the grocery store was rude to me about something, like my coupon. Or like somebody always wronged them. Or they'll tell you a story about some sort of conflict that they had with somebody to do what? Little pop quiz here. It's getting pretty obvious that the answers are always the same. But I want to ask you, what do you think the storytelling mode, how do you think that serves us? Why do you think we do that? There's a lot of reasons depending on the person and their ego, but it's really to just, again, protect ourselves. We think we're protecting ourselves and our identity, our self-worth by making someone else wrong and making ourselves into a victim. This is like just something that I experience often with other people. I feel like the most interesting thing they think they have to talk about, because it makes them feel important to be a victim, it makes them feel like they are worth talking about, or they got their sense of attention, people caring and noticing them when in a victimized state. So it's like the pattern of someone always wronged them, there's always an issue, there's always something to complain about, somebody's, and this isn't just like, oh, today this happened. It could be like bringing up something that happened 5 years ago that like they're still clinging to protect their sense of identity, like to make themselves feel more important, or to make them feel, oh, what's the easiest way to explain this? You probably already understand listening, but it's basically like to prove to themselves that their insecurities are not warranted. Like sometimes people do like really play right into our deepest insecurities. They might say something that really speaks directly to them and kind of points them out. And we don't, like, nobody wants to hear that, especially. So we might really cling to that and almost like basically ask for reassurance every possible chance we can possibly get. Like, without even realizing that we're doing it. And it could be days, months, years down the road, we still need to bring up that event to either confirm to ourselves that no, like that couldn't possibly be, that somebody didn't like me, or like they're just a bad person, or that, you know, that interaction didn't happen because I'm not likable or whatever. It's because that person is rude. That person is, again, just all the list goes on and on. We can eliminate this pattern pretty obviously, but we also, like, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be this victim state, or like this like overt, like loud complainer personality type that you might be envisioning, because I definitely think I go there first when thinking about this concept. I do this all the time too, with just like little interactions that I might have, I don't know, even like with my social media platforms, like somebody might, there's many things that people have said to me, written to me, that I was like, wow, that felt really like invasive, like, because I share a lot of like my personal life, and I've shared a lot of like really personal things, and so people sometimes often feel like they really know me, and like they really, I don't know, they almost like start to like really evaluate me, which is a really interesting concept to like know of, like to know that it's happening, and then to like experience the not aftermath, but you know, like experience the outcome of that, like to opening up your life to other people. Like obviously they're going to comment on it, and sometimes they'll get comfortable enough to comment on it directly to you, and sometimes I like think about some of the things that people have written to me, and I do that. I'm like, wow, is that true about me? Like I wonder, like, wow, is that how people see me, you know? Like ask myself these questions, and why am I doing that? Because it's my ego is scared, like, oh no, would that mean that I'm like not as good of a person? Or if that were true, does that mean I'm not as worthy of sharing what I share? Or if that were true, like, do I come off pretentious or like annoying? Like, I mean, I literally had someone once write on accident, like they were sending my video to someone else and they wrote, oh my gosh, she's so annoying, or something like that, but sent it directly to me. I had another one, personal friend sent a thing about me and my husband to me, again, directly, but meant to send it to someone else, saying like, what an odd couple, or something like that. And I'm like, man, like some of these things, like clearly it's been a long time since either of those occasions happened, and they come right to the forefront of my brain when I think of like what are the examples I have of this in my own personal life, like where I think about something that somebody said months ago years ago. And there's so many examples that I can't even count, but I like kind of sharing some personal ones because I think it's helpful for other people too to hear, like, this doesn't, again, like, it doesn't have to be some like dramatic, oh, I like go about my day like telling people about this. But I definitely feel like we've all been there too, like where you have an uncomfortable interaction with somebody and the first thing that you want to do is like text your best friend and be like, oh my gosh, like you'll never believe what just happened. This person was like the worst to me. They said this to me, like how like crazy or whatever. And like you just want them to reassure you like, yeah, that person's the worst. And like, why would they do that? And like, why would they say that? Oh my gosh, I can't believe that. You're so amazing, right? Like, it's all ego. And I just think that I only wish to get to the point where I have the duck brain in this area of life where you can just kind of shake off any of that surplus energy, that negative energy from the negative emotions that you're experiencing. And then just like keep swimming in the other direction or in the same direction, like nothing happened. And I know that this could potentially lead some people really interpreting it to like an extreme and being like, oh, wouldn't that mean you just like don't need to process anything that's traumatic or anything that's hard? And that's not really what I'm saying either. I think that it's more just about like those, again, like those stories that we're telling ourselves. Like if you're healing from something and you're evaluating experience that you had that was traumatic to better understand like your, you know, how you respond in your day-to-day life and how you're feeling inside, that's a very different thing than constantly telling yourself a story about either being a victim or how like, yeah, I would have done this or here's what I would have said instead of like, and like, oh, if I could only go back, this is what I would have told them. Or just again, like getting into that egoic place of hierarchy and superiority or inferiority and just like playing it over and over again in your head. It's just, that's actually not therapeutic at all. That becomes depression, that becomes anxiety, and that also just becomes misery, in my opinion. Like you just make yourself miserable and it's just not a place of presence where that's where we want to be. We want to be able to be truly present so that we can also be at peace. And I think that just being like the duck and shaking things off, shaking it off, you physically really doing that is not just, that is helpful. But I think also using that sort of as a metaphor of like doing what you need to do to evaluate, okay, like what happened? Why do I feel the way that I feel about it? What do I really think about that? What is my ego trying to tell me I think about that? Well, where is what my ego is telling me, where are those thoughts coming from? Okay, like, so how could this situation actually possibly serve me? Like, how can I better understand the people in my life? How am I showing up in my life? Like, what is there like that I can do to make the situation better and like to either change it or just accept it? And that's where peace and presence come in. So shaking it off doesn't have to just be like, nothing matters. I don't feel anything. Ha 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 ho, ho, ho. No, like don't be ridiculous. That's obviously not the way that people work. We have like highs and lows, and we need a healthy way to process all the experiences that we have. And I think that again, the awareness is the ultimate key to being in that sort of like shake it off state and like, okay, I'm just gonna swim, like, and let go, like just drift off. That happened, but it happened in the past. It happened, so I can either accept it or I can do things differently so that I can prevent that kind of thing from happening again. But I don't need to like keep telling myself the story about it over and over and over again. Let go of the story and return to the only place of power, and that is the present moment. There's a really great analogy, well, story that Eckhart shares in this chapter as well that I've shared a lot of times on my platform because I think it's so powerful. And it was really helpful for me I experienced a lot of trauma and adversity and became a single mom and experienced some more adversity and whatever. And I remember during that time, like, it was a really peaceful time in a lot of ways in my life. And I really attribute it to a lot of the things that I learned in this book. And there's this particular story that really stands out for me when I think of, like, the lessons that I was learning at that time about how to cope with a challenging circumstance where it could people want you almost to, like, fall into this role of the victim and, oh, woe is me, and, like, throw a pity party basically every day and, like, talk all the time about how hard your situation is or, like, how awful what happened to you was. And I just remember feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm so liberated. That's the last thing on my mind. Like, I just want to have the best days. The last thing I want to do is sit around and think and storytell and talk about the past. It's definitely not going to serve me to do it, at least not in that way. Obviously, again, in, like, a therapy setting or, like, a setting with, like, a trusted loved one that is of sound mind and presence, right? Like, to be able to, like, confide in them and, like, kind of release certain things. But even, like, journaling and praying, talking to God about it, like, just was such a better alternative for me. And this story, anyway, was really an amazing thing that I always kept in mind. And he talks about how the inability, or rather unwillingness, of the human mind to let go of the past is beautifully illustrated in the story of two Zen monks. They were walking along a country road that had become extremely muddy after heavy rains. Near a village, they came upon a young woman who was trying to cross the road, but the mud was so deep it would have ruined the silk kimono she was wearing. Tenzin, one of the monks, at once picked her up and carried her to the other side. The monks walked on in silence. 5 hours later, as they were approaching the lodging temple, Ikeda couldn't restrain himself any longer. "Why did you carry that girl across the road? We monks are not supposed to do things like that." "I put the girl down hours ago," said Tenzin. "Are you still carrying her?" Now imagine what life would be like for somebody who lived like Ikeda all the time, unable or unwilling to let go internally of situations, accumulating more and more stuff inside. And you get a sense of what life is like for the majority of people on our planet. What a heavy burden of past they carry around with them in their minds. The past lives in you as memories, but memories in themselves are not a problem. In fact, it's through memory that we learn from the past and from past mistakes. Like what I was saying, it's not like, oh, I'm just going to forget it and move on. It's like, no, we can absolutely process things and heal from them and learn from them in a present way where we're not making ourselves out to be a victim or a victor or like some sort of egoic attachment to it. We're just like, we can objectively view it and learn that way. It says, it is only when memories, that is to say thoughts about the past, take you over completely that they turn into a burden, turn problematic, and become part of your sense of self. Your personality, which is conditioned by the past, then becomes your prison. Your memories are invested with a sense of self, and your story becomes who you perceive yourself to be. This little me is an illusion that obscures your true identity as timeless and formless presence. Your story, however, consists not only of mental, but also of emotional memory. Old emotion that is being revived continuously. As in the case of the monk who carried the burden of his resentment for 5 hours by feeding it with his thoughts, most people carry a large amount of unnecessary baggage, both mental and emotional, throughout their lives. They limit themselves through grievances, regret, hostility, guilt. Their emotional... I like that he says that you limit yourself with those things. Letting go of them, like how I described, like I felt so liberated moving into this new circumstance, you know, into single motherhood across the country. I moved with nothing and had very, very little, like, but at the same time, I was just so focused on being present, That was my goal, like just being present with my son and allowing, you know, my true essence to be at the forefront, not like some story of who I am now. I was a mom raising my son by himself, but it wasn't like, oh, this is my identity. It's like, it's who I am now. That's what I was doing. It wasn't who I was. I hope that makes sense, you know, and that would be like the little me. That would be an illusion of me, not my true timeless, formless self. As in, and I like how he talks about, yeah, so I talked about the limitations that come with holding on to all of that actual baggage. You know, the whole thing is like a metaphor. Like, are you still holding the girl? Like, what do you mean? Like, I put her down. I put her down 5 hours ago. But this whole time, can you imagine, like, if we really talked about things like that? Like, why? Like, why are we still holding on to that? And imagine also, I think it's easy to imagine because we've all been there and done this exact thing. Probably, maybe even today we've done it. This week, like, something happens and then you do just tell yourself a story about it for hours afterward. Like, you can imagine to the T what the other monk was saying in his mind. I'm going to say something to him. That's not acceptable. Oh my gosh, I can't believe he would do that. I would never do that. Like, just building the snowball of resentment and superiority and pretension, like, that feel so gross in the body and that just, like, aren't productive at all or helpful at all. Even when he does address it 5 hours later in the story, it's not productive. Like, what was that conversation going to do? You shouldn't have done that, okay? You know, in parenting, I say, like, one of my favorite people says, you shouldn't should all over people. And it's so true. Should is, like, basically just shame. You should have done something implies that, you know, that you should be different, that should have been different, and you're disappointed. It's implying disappointment and, you know, just dislike. I don't like what you decided to do. You should have done this, or you should be this way, implies you don't like what somebody, how they are currently being. And so should, and what that, the monk was like, oh, well, you shouldn't have done that. It's like, even if you got to the point where you're actually addressing something that you're uncomfortable with, right? Like Eckhart says, either change the situation or accept it. So, like, okay, maybe this is just effort. I'm going to address my thoughts or whatever with this person. But are we doing it in an egoic way or a productive way? That is not even productive. It's just shame. Okay, shame and criticism. They don't help the situation. They don't change the situation. In fact, they just make it worse because it's just your ego in play. So he says here, their emotional thinking has become their self, and so they hang on to the old emotion because it strengthens their identity. Because of the human tendency to perpetuate old emotion, almost everyone carries in his or her energy field an accumulation of old emotional pain, which I call the pain body. We can, however, stop adding to the pain body that we already have. We can learn to break the habit of accumulating and perpetuating old emotion by flapping our wings, metaphorically speaking, and refrain from mentally dwelling on the past, regardless of whether something happened yesterday or 30 years ago. We can learn not to keep situations or events alive in our minds, but to return our attention continuously to the pristine, timeless present moment, rather than be caught up in mental movie making. It's one of my favorite expressions he uses. We do really, and how often, I wish I could talk to you all like face to face, but raise your hand in your car, where you're wherever you're listening on the Stairmaster, raise your hand to yourself if you've ever been caught up in mental movie making about something that didn't even happen. Like, you're thinking, you're playing out hypothetical situations and interactions, like what you're going to say to somebody or how you're going to address something or what you should have said or what you would have done, or even replaying situations where, again, like, you're not, it's not even like a gotcha thing. You're feeling that inferiority aspect of the ego. Oh my gosh, like, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe, like, I just met them. I'm like complete oversharer. Like, I talk so much. Did I sound annoying? Was I like being so overbearing? Or like, how are they like looking at me? Did I even notice? Did I look stupid? Did I dress in a silly way? Like, what was I thinking? Like, that's movie making. You're just getting caught up in the past, and it's just not productive. It's not helpful. It's not serving you. And it's also just like so silly when you think about like what your actual brain is doing, trying to keep you safe by telling yourself all kinds of weird stories through old conditioned thought patterns. You can just turn it off. You can just turn off the movie and be like, whoa. And actually, one of my other favorite authors, Harville Hendrix, uses this exact same expression when talking about, and also Marshall Rosenberg, one of my all-time favorite authors. They all kind of say this exact same thing about, like, if you actually want to be present in your relationships and when you talk to somebody else, in order to actually listen and understand another person, including yourself, like, you got to turn off the mental movie. You've got to turn it off and listen with your full body. Just be in the present moment. This is where the good stuff happens, where we feel truly in touch with our state of being and with other people and their state of being. This is where we can really connect with each other and ourselves. Eckhart Tolle writes, "Nothing ever happened in the past that can prevent you from being present now. And if the past cannot prevent you from being present now, what power does it have? What power does it have over you?" This is where we get to make the decision again to be empowered and say, and this is, I'm talking as a person that I could have very loud thoughts, okay, about my past and things that happened to me that very blatantly made me a victim in a situation. And I just choose to say, like, I'm not going to let this continue to have power over me. If something awful awful things happened, I was powerless in that present moment when it was happening, I'm not going to continue to give away my precious present moment. I'm not going to continue to give away my power to something that's not happening anymore. I don't want to operate there. And I really encourage you guys listening, if you struggle with this, to say the same thing. Be like, I'm not, look, maybe in that moment, in that past present moment, I was powerless, I was helpless, or like it was terrible and painful. I'm not going to continue to be in pain. I'm not going to choose to keep being in pain and keep suffering and making myself suffer mentally and then physically because of just staying in this low vibrational negative state. Empower yourself to be in your power, to be in the present moment. Don't allow the past to have power over you. It cannot prevent you from being present now if you don't want it to. And if there's a little part of you that maybe wants it to, that maybe is clinging to the attention or the love, the connection that you might have felt as a result of this circumstance, this past that you're holding on to, remind yourself that it pales in comparison to the love and connection that you can experience by being in the productive present moment, where the true essence of you can shine forth. The other one is just like a little tiny blip. It's just an illusion of self that you've created, of this identity of who you are because of the story that you tell. It's not the real you. So you don't need to be afraid about losing it, losing your grip on it. That's not even the best you. It's like this a terrible representation. It's like a fake little illusion that you're holding on to. So just let go of it. Let go of it. And you should be excited about what that will free up for you, the potential of what's to come when you let go of it, what's actually waiting for you in the present moment, when you can actually rest in the present and rest in the joy and the peace That's where you want to be. And that's definitely where you want to be if you've got children learning from you, watching from you, being with you. Which is a perfect segue into the individual and collective pain body. Any negative emotion that's not fully faced and seen for what it is in the moment it arises does not completely dissolve. It leaves behind a remnant of pain. Children in particular find strong negative emotions too overwhelming to cope with and tend to try not to feel them. In the absence, and you know, I have something to say about that. Because although I feel like, yes, you know, that's true, I think that this is definitely something that's conditioned in children from infancy. We say, shush, 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 we pacify them. We even get really frustrated and we bounce and act insane when our kids are crying as a collective, myself included. You know, like, I'm like, okay, don't, like, I have to fight the urge to send the message to my children when they're having a hard time. Like, I still, to this day, knowing everything that I know and teaching it and talking about it all the time, have to, in my own personal experience, when my children are really having a hard time, really having, like, a super uncomfortable emotional experience, I have to remind myself, like, Kate, this is normal. This is part of being a human. Sometimes you just are really dysregulated, really frustrated, really upset, like really disappointed. And also sometimes you're just hangry. You need to eat something or you didn't eat good food. And like, this is the result. And like, your body is just out of sorts. And like, this is what happens. We don't need to like fix and correct and stop it. Like, it's, everybody's gonna be okay. It's not an emergency. Like, our children can have a hard time. It is not the end of the world. Like, even pouting, even like a little bit of pouting, my first instinct because of my childhood conditioning is to, in my mind, be like, how ungrateful. We did this. We did that today. We did that. And like, now you have the nerve to be, oh, like disappointed because it's not enough or that's not good enough or we didn't go there at that second. Like, how ungrateful, like how spoiled, whatever. Because that is the exact, those are the exact words of my own parent, like coming into my brain as I watch my son or daughter, right? And I'm like, how interesting to be able to observe that and to have awareness around it. I'm really grateful that it doesn't spew out onto my children because that would suck. But again, that's also human too, right? Like, that's what happens. Like, we have this inner critical parent and the ego that's telling us, you should be scared. Your kid's going to be a spoiled brat. They're entitled. They're this, they're that, just like your mom said you were. And like, we, again, have the privilege here to build awareness and to stop those crazy, intrusive, old negative conditioned thought patterns. And we can simply get present and acknowledge the normalcy in the wide range of emotional states that we all experience. Like, I don't, anyway, all of this was just to say that I think that children can be taught from a very early age, like, that they don't like experiencing heightened emotional states, strong negative emotions. They find them too overwhelming. I think that because that's like a normal part of being human to have these ebbs and flows in our emotional state. I mean, unless you really nailed presence and like no attachments whatsoever, which I also think is kind of something we have to model and teach our children. But unless you've nailed that like completely and you never have any sort of ups and downs and you've like completely healed yourself of any sort of trauma and conditioning, which, amazing job if you're there. But I feel like there's something to be said about the conditioning that we send, the messaging that we send our children from very, very early on about this and how comfortable they can become moving forward with, like, again, understanding like what it means to be human. You know, we might feel all the feels and that's okay. It's just like how to develop healthy coping mechanisms for them, how to actually regulate our emotions in a healthy way. He says, in the absence of a fully conscious adult who guides them with love and compassionate understanding into facing the emotion directly, choosing to not to feel it is indeed the only option for the child at that time. This is exactly what I'm talking about. Like, we can condition our children, like, if we don't operate out of love and compassionate understanding and facing the emotion head on and saying, like, this is how you feel. Been there. I'm here. I'm riding it out with you. I'm your anchor. It's all good. We're here together. Like, if you need to cry, I'm here. Like, that, sending that message loud and clear. The only other option for children is just to not feel it, to, like, let it accumulate in the body. And unfortunately, that early defense mechanism usually remains in place when the child becomes an adult. The emotion still lives in them, unrecognized, and manifests indirectly, for example, as anxiety, anger outbursts of violence, a mood, or even as a physical illness. In some cases, it interferes with or sabotages every intimate relationship. Most psychotherapists have met patients who claimed initially to have had a totally happy childhood, and later the opposite turned out to be the case. Those may be the more extreme cases, but nobody can go through childhood without suffering emotional pain. Even if both of your parents were enlightened, you would still find yourself growing up in a largely unconscious world. That's another really important thing to remember. Like, even if you're really doing all you can and you're very fortunate people that you and your partner are on the same page, you're like, let's grow, let's move into a more conscious, aware state. We want to be present. We want to raise our children consciously. You're going to be doing so in a world of people that don't want to do that, that are not ready to take those steps. And that's okay as well, but it is going to result in, you know, some suffering for everybody. And that's just the way life goes. But more consciousness makes it easier, right? Like, conscious suffering, it's not really going to be suffering if you're aware of it and where it's coming from, which is at least helpful. He says, the remnants of pain left behind by every strong negative emotion that's not fully faced, accepted, and then let go of, join together to form an energy field that lives in the very cells of your body. It consists not just of childhood pain, but also painful emotions that were added to it later in adolescence and during your adult life, much of it created by the voice of the ego. It is the emotional pain that is your unavoidable companion when a false sense of self is the basis of your life. The energy field of old but still very much alive emotion that lives in almost every human being is the pain body. And Eckhart mentions that people with heavy pain bodies usually have a better chance to awaken spiritually or develop this awareness and consciousness, this conscious state of being that we're talking about here, than those with a relatively light pain body. And it's really because they get to a point. I mean, some people will, as he puts it, be trapped in this heavy pain body, and that'll be their identity. But others will get to the point where they can't live with that level of unhappiness any longer, and their motivation to awaken becomes strong. This reminds me of something Tony Robbins always talks about. I love Tony Robbins, and I always talk about him, but and what I learned from him. But what he says over and over again in his work is that people will change their habits, their lifestyle, their state of being only when the fear of their current circumstance is greater than the fear of change, is greater than the fear of whatever steps they have to take to move into a different direction, to change their life. And I really think that this is kind of the same thing, right? Like, sometimes the pain body just gets so intense, people will quote unquote hit their rock bottom, and that's when they're like, I have to make a shift, I have to live more consciously, I have to understand, like, why do I do what I do and think how I think and feel how I feel. I need to shift and awaken, basically, literally wake up. I think it is more likely if you have a heavy pain body sometimes for that to happen, and which he's talked about that in the past, and I've mentioned that in these podcast episodes, that, you know, that really uncomfortable aspect of allowing for suffering to be a good thing. I just touched on it a second ago. But knowing that suffering leads to enlightenment, suffering leads to depth, a better understanding of in a better, more compassionate understanding of the world around you and other people, if we allow it to lead us to kind of awaken and open our eyes and develop this awareness that it can be kind of a gift, even though it's literally a painful one. He talks about how the pain body sort of like needs to feed itself, similar to the ego. It needs to kind of take in new energy, and the food, so to speak, that it requires consists of energy that's compatible with its own, which is energy that vibrates at a similar frequency. Any emotionally painful experience can be used as food for the pain body, and that's why it thrives on negative thinking as well as drama in relationships. The pain body is an addiction to unhappiness. Some people also, especially in the therapy world, use the expression addicted to excitement. This is sort of the same thing. Anything that's going to get you into a state of fight or flight mode, or just disassociation, like just getting you into that survival brain, can really feed the pain body. It's getting you into that low vibrational state of like, okay, I need to operate out of a place of fear. That's where it thrives. And you might be like, well, that's not me. I definitely am not seeking unhappiness or seeking emotional negativity. And you need a lot of awareness to recognize this in yourself. And I call myself out on this all the time. Like if I'm on social media and I see something sort of like negative or very a very sort of reactive post that like makes you want to have a reaction, and I start to like read the comments or whatever, and I feel like this impulse to respond or to reply or like make my own comment. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's my pain body at work. My pain body is literally like looking for food. It's like, I need negativity. I need to like, and my ego too is at work there. Like, oh, I'm going to like prove a point here. I'm going to like, you know, state my case, even though it's literally not going to change anything and not help anybody reading this, because they don't want my input. They just want to share their own and like their own egoic whatever. Like that's the whole point of what's happening. But me reading through the comments, especially if I have nothing that I want to say and nothing that I'm going to actually share that's going to be helpful or productive, that's the pain body. I'm literally like, ooh, like, yeah, negativity. Same thing with, like, reality television. Man, like, the Kardashians, like, watching them have an argument or something. This is all the pain body. And I think it's interesting to observe it in ourselves and to be able to develop that awareness around it as well, because it's very humbling, in my opinion. Especially when it comes to the way the pain body operates in relationships, and how, again, we have these expectations for other people, this egoic form of love, quote unquote love, where when people don't live up to our expectations, or they aren't being who we want them to be in the relationship, or what we've rolled out for them in terms of their worthiness blueprint in our marriage or relationship, this could be our spouse or our children, we can turn on them, right? And it can turn quite hostile or even passive. Similarly to how I mentioned, we don't have to see this big display of negativity and complaint for somebody to be operating from their pain body and their ego. They could just be scrolling, looking for negativity, really sort of like not wanting negative content to end, not wanting to stop consuming that sort of thing or participating in that sort of thing, or even listening to certain conversation or participating in certain conversations, different interactions that you might have, even eavesdropping in the locker room. I was listening to a conversation between some ladies in the locker room and I was like, wow, why am I eating this up? This is drama. This is negativity. But I was being entertained by it. And I was the whole time thinking, I think this is my pain body, honestly, that's enjoying this negativity, enjoying this drama. And I don't want to operate here, but there's a part of me that's enjoying it. And I think just like it's important to notice that it can look very different and still be the same thing. If you've ever said, when someone says, "What's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong," or "I'm fine," and your entire being is communicating the opposite, that's the pain body at work, kind of like eating up the negativity, eating up all of the negative thought patterns that are probably going through your mind about everything that is wrong, everything this person didn't do, or the way they did it, whatever, as opposed to simply objectively communicating your needs in a clear, effective way. I think that it's just an important other aspect to consider and reflect on. The pain body and how it shows up isn't always this hostile, big display. Sometimes it can be very quiet. Sometimes it can be very passive. But I think that they feel the same way. You know, I mean, obviously one is more extreme than the other. If you're in a really heightened emotional state versus a sort of quiet, passive, aggressive state. But the energy feels very similar to me, like just as icky. Both of them feel really uncomfortable in the body, and they're just, it's not present. It's not you. It's not like the real intrinsic essence of you that's present in those moments. And another fun one to build awareness around. Eckhart also mentions entertainment, the media, and the pain body. He asked the question, why do violent films attract such large audiences? There's an entire industry, a large part of it, which fuels the human addiction to unhappiness. People obviously watch those films because they want to feel bad. What is it in humans that loves to feel bad and call it good? The pain body, of course. A large part of the entertainment industry caters to it. So in addition to reactivity, negative thinking, and personal drama, the pain body also renews itself vicariously through the cinema and television screen. He writes that pain bodies write and produce the films, and pain bodies pay to watch them. I've always found it really interesting that we as people, especially after reading this book, will watch things and allow our children to consume things that we would never want them to see and we would never want ourselves to see in real life. But because it's someone acting it out, we deem it okay and completely normal to watch. And these are like horrific things. Again, if you even saw a real life fight break out in the street, someone punch another person in the face that like led them to be bloody, or and like their whatever it's called, your fist, like getting broken bones in their hand or something from punching this other person, it would be kind of traumatizing in a way. That's like very, it's, your body would obviously go into a heightened state of fight or flight mode. It's not a healthy thing to see, obviously, energetically. This is very low vibrational, the insanity for someone to hit another person. It just goes without saying that if your children saw this, it would be disturbing and you would be distraught about that. I'm assuming the majority of people would feel that way. And yet, we share this with our kids. Like, we completely normalize violence from a very early age. I have a son who's 6 years old, and we have movie nights on Fridays, and it's a whole complicated thing. You know, when he talks to other children his age or even only a year or so older, I have to kind of go through this entire spiel with him as to why we just don't think it's appropriate. We don't think it's healthy. It's not going to bless you to watch stuff that you would never want to watch in real life, or play a game that allows you to do things or see things that we wouldn't want you to see in real life, that wouldn't feel good and that wouldn't be good for your heart and your mind, your soul. And it's really hard for a six-year-old to truly comprehend, or even 10-year-old, you know, I think, unless you're constantly modeling that and really reassuring them that that's what's normal, to not revel in violence and really enjoy it and get this sort of deep-rooted psychological satisfaction out of watching someone get hurt or even worse, which again is very common. The number of murders that the average 10-year-old sees is in the thousands, like by the time they're 10 years old and they're watching it being depicted in cartoons, movies, television series. That's 10. I mean, I can't even imagine. I'm pretty sure that the study that I read that from was done in the late 90s. That's before we could stream things and have things on our iPads and little tablets, devices constantly at our fingertips. Who knows what the number is now, and how fascinating is it that we've gotten to a point where that's just so normalized. I even remember when growing up, there was criticism about video games being too violent and it being a cause of actual violence in the real world. And moms that would say, yeah, I'm not allowing my son to play these games, or my daughter, whoever, to play these games, they're too violent. They would be kind of criticized as over the top and so sensitive. It's just so interesting how we just normalize so many very obviously unusual things. It's not normal. It's just not normal to hurt somebody else, or to like punch them, or definitely use weapons on them. It's complete insanity, and it's all a result of the pain body. He mentioned that it's not always wrong to show and watch violence on television and in cinema. It doesn't necessarily all cater to the pain body if it's shared in a way that encompasses the whole effect and experience that happens from as a result of violence. So what it does to the victim, what it does to the perpetrator in the long term, show the collective unconsciousness that lies behind it and is passed on from generation to generation, the anger, the hatred that lives in humans as the pain body, then that can fulfill a vital function in the awakening of humanity. That can act as a mirror in which humanity sees its own insanity, that in you, which recognizes madness as madness, even if it is your own, is sanity, is the arising awareness, is the end of insanity. And so that's how movies can be a helpful tool. Such films do exist, and they do not fuel the pain body. Some of the best anti-war films are films that show the reality of war rather than a glamorized version of it. The pain body can only feed on films in which violence is portrayed as normal or even desirable human behavior, or that glorify violence with the sole purpose of generating negative emotion in the viewer and so become a fix for the pain-addicted pain body. And obviously you could think of a million things. Marvel is a perfect example of this, and I know people are probably like, no, but I love it. Don't come for me and my superheroes or whatever. My parents have an entire like superhero Marvel themed basement. My parents live for this stuff. They love movies, they love TV shows, and I'm always peeing on their fun, ruining their time with my assessment of what it is that they consume. Like, what is it telling you for you to normalize this? Or what is it in you that wants to enjoy like this glorification of things that you would be, again, extremely traumatized by if you were to see it happen in real time? Even Marvel, obviously, you're probably like, what do you mean I would never see somebody do some of these things in real time? Like, I don't know, people like on another planet or whatever. I don't know enough about it to even... I feel like I'm always sharing pop cultural references in here in my podcast and my videos, but it's probably because of that influence. My parents love TV and movies, so I think it's so fascinating that, like, in even, let's say, Spider-Man, right? Like, kicking somebody in the jaw, like, punching somebody. I think somebody gets shot, right, in the first movie, Uncle Ben. And, you know, watching him like hold his uncle until he takes his last breath, like that's not even normal. That's a huge red flag for the pain body, for anybody that's experienced loss, anybody that, and that's been painful for them. That just add it to the pain body. Like, it lights the pain body up, it feeds it, because we're literally watching something that reminds the pain body of the actual pain it's experienced and not really face head on, processed, and been able to release, like freed from the body. It's an ongoing process. And again, something that's happening to people at a younger and younger age. But the beautiful thing is there are opportunities for watching certain things that depict violence or the insanity that is human, the human experience. And they do so in a way that actually leads to enlightenment and not the opposite, this sort of glorification. Look how cool this guy is for using a gun and hurting people. Or like, let's, this guy's so cool for kicking people and hitting people. And like, even if it's, oh, he gets the bad guys, some people might use that as a justification to normalize it, like the Ninja Turtle. Well, they're just hitting the bad guys, hitting and punching the bad guys. It's like, but they're still hitting and punching and kicking and using weapons. That's not normal. It's literally not even legal. If you did the exact same thing on the street right now at the mall or something, you'd be insane. Like, they would arrest you. It's strange to glorify this and to normalize it. And all it is a result of the pain body, us wanting to fuel it. I've talked to my brother about this. My brother loves MMA. And he says, yeah, it's 100%. This like deeper weird part of my subconscious that's like enjoying somebody getting hurt, because maybe there's a part of him that like wants to hurt someone or has been hurt in that way. Like, it's just so interesting. And maybe that's too personal. Sorry, it's my brother, but it is what it is. It comes with the territory. I always share things that are too personal. Anyway, I think it's just helpful. I think I share that stuff because it's helpful to hear a real example, you know. Moving on and really wrapping up this episode, I like that he finishes with the concept that the real perpetrator of evil here in our world is human unconsciousness. That's what creates all of this insanity collectively, individually. That's what creates all of these harmful decisions that we make as people, the damage that we do to each other in our relationships, whether it be intimate relationships or just day-to-day interactions that we have with other people. Unconsciousness is at the root of anything harmful and not good for society and for the individual. That realization, he says, is true forgiveness. With forgiveness, your victim identity dissolves and your true power emerges, the power of presence. Instead of blaming the darkness, you bring in the light. And what an empowering statement that is. Just like everything here, you know, and this is why I always say that this book is so deeply transformative, so helpful and healing, therapeutic, because the emphasis is not rooted in fear and being in this survival state. I listen to this Tony Robbins thing almost every morning. It's a priming exercise. And there's breathing exercises involved and visualizing times in your life where you were so proud of yourself and empowered and excited about life and moments that were so special that you shared with other people. And then at the end, he says, like, this is the real you. This is who you really are, behind fear, away from survival mode. And every time, every morning, it's just as refreshing as it was the day before, because we have so been primed and conditioned to operate there all the time in survival mode, in control mode, in fear mode with ourselves, with other people, right? But whether it's our inner critical parent that was operating that way that still seeps into our thought patterns and it's hard to like recondition those, or the way that we operate with our own kids, our spouse, our boss, whoever it is, who we really are. To bring forth the light, like he says, instead of blaming the darkness and putting our focus, our energy there, we can just focus on being empowered, being present, and all the beautiful things that come from being in that state. It's like your unshakable state too, where you can really work from compassion. When we move away from that, blaming the darkness, focusing on all the negativity, all the negative stuff, and all the who did this right or wrong, and the superiority or inferiority dynamics, we actually get to move into those, again, like beautiful zones, curiosity, wonderment about other people, true compassion, a real human connectedness that is so healing for everybody. And like I said, I keep using the word transformative, but imagine if collectively we could all operate there. What a peaceful world we could create, and what peaceful relationships, and how marriages would shift, and the confidence that these young people being raised, like my children, you know, would develop. Just how beautiful and how fulfilling and amazing that would be. I hope you guys enjoyed this conversation, though long-winded. I think really, for me, it's helpful even just to look over this work again and to kind of like work through it in my mind and digest and process the material. I really hope that it has been helpful for you and insightful and something that you can take into your day moving forward, your weeks, your months in your life and in your relationships to have a more joyful, present life experience. If you enjoyed this, please let me know. Give me some feedback on Instagram, or you can reach me at YouTube, my website. You can email me. Thank you so much for listening. I know everybody says that at the end of their podcast or whatever work they share, but I know that the work that I share is like really deep and it's often really long, especially these Eckhart Tolle episodes have been pretty long. And I really share it from a deep place in my heart with hope that it'll reach somebody and it'll transform the way they view their life and their relationships and, you know, be able to just talk to themselves a little bit nicer today and talk to the people around them in a more compassionate, truly, unconditionally loving, present way. I just think that all of our gifts, I just keep reiterating the same things, but you know, they just so easily emerge when we're in our natural essence, free of all of those layers that we've been conditioned with. So the fact that you are listening with me and processing all this information with me is more meaningful than you know. I am just so grateful that you listen, that you're here, you support me, and I hope that I support you just as much by putting this work out there into the world. Thanks again. If you are interested in checking out my online course all about parenting and reparenting, go to www.themellowmama.org. It's a wonderful streamlined resource where all in one place, you and especially a spouse, if you are looking to grow together as a couple as you raise your children or bring a baby into the world, basically, again, digest and process these deeper concepts when it comes to raising children and the kind of relationship that you want to foster and develop. It's all right there in one place instead of having to like read this book and pick and choose. I think that it's in a really, it's a beautiful, simple one-stop shop where, again, you can kind of work through it at your own pace, module by module, and talk about it with your spouse or your partner, and really kind of get to the healing work without, you know, even having to go anywhere. You can kind of just do this on your own time at home, when the kids are asleep or before bed or whatever. I think that it can be really fruitful for you and your family, and that's definitely what course students have said. So check that out, mellowmama.org. You can enroll there. And you can always start with my free resources as well. This podcast being a great example, the Mellow Mama YouTube channel. There are over 80 videos on that platform, and all of them I watch, you know, sometimes I watch old videos and I'm like, yeah, like this is really solid information. I put a lot of time and effort and research into those. So check out the YouTube channel, the Mellow Mama. And you can find me on TikTok and Instagram as well at the same name. I hope you have an amazing day. Please take this information and put it into practice. And I will see you guys on the next episode.